speaker is Ian J. Thompson, Ph.D. He's the director of the Surrey Center for Nuclear Physics. The title of his talk, which I wrote down, is Are Quantum Physics and Spirituality Related? And like I said, people like to talk about quantum physics, that spooky level of physics, and spirituality. A lot of people do. But often, it's people who know a lot about spirituality, but not much about physics, like me, or it's people who know a lot about physics, but not much about spirituality. And that's okay, but here comes a man who knows a lot about both. And so I think it's going to be very interesting to see what he has to say. So Ian, that's your time.
Reuben has explained this part of the background. I don't really have time to go into all of the background which has led me to this path, but I'm very pleased to be invited here and to follow in the illustrious steps of David here, and at last to meet a number of people who I've heard mentioned by name on many occasions. But it's good to meet some of them and see what they really like. So the purpose of my little short presentation is to discuss the questions of quantum physics and spirituality together to see what the connection between them is. And the reason we need to discuss the connection is that very often people want to identify these things. There's some tendency, a widespread feeling that somehow they're connected, but people want to say that quantum physics tells us about spirituality. But we know that's not quite so simple, and so we want to understand in detail a bit more of what's going on. So just to remind you about where quantum physics comes in, I'll remind those of you that have done physics courses in which quantum physics has been remembered, these are some of the things to remind you about the problems that behave. That one of the problems is that particles in modern physics discovers that they're not just little lumps that travel around, but they behave as waves. Electrons, which we think of as the prime example of a little particle, can be scattered by interference patterns going through slits or going around corners or from crystals. It gets reflected like a wave. And furthermore, these waves are probability waves. So we don't say it's definitely in one place, but we have a distribution of probabilities. And the form of this distribution can be worked out very accurately in quantum physics, and it makes very precise predictions, but only about the probabilities. It doesn't tell us exactly where the particle is. So this is one of the puzzles, is to understand why and how and what's really going on when particles behave like waves. But the other side of it is that waves, light waves, we think of as light waves, we know what colors are, and we think of it as wavelengths of oscillations. These behave like particles. This is the way quantum physics started, because Max Planck, almost just over 100 years ago, showed that he could solve many of some fundamental problems in quantum physics by assuming that light waves was not just a smooth oscillating wave like Maxwell and others and Faraday had thought, but came a little. The energy came in lumps, which are called quanta, or quanta for counting. So that these two problems that appeared in quantum physics are called the problems of wave-particle duality, and the task that quantum physicists have is trying to understand what the connection is between those two features of quantum physics. I'm not going to say much more about the physics side, but I'm going to come back to some of these in a general way, and I want to ask, what is the nature? What's really going on in nature? What's that the quantum physics is telling us? So there's two parts to this transparency. The first part is just a summary of the previous transparency, that small particles in nature are not little corpuscles or solid bodies that with rigid edges, the way Newton and Boyle and Locke thought in the 1700s, in the 17th century. But they're more like clouds of tendencies or propensities. And the shape of these clouds is worked out very accurately in quantum mechanics. That's what the wave function is called. But they don't just stay clouds, because they somehow still maintain some unity. So what I'm saying is that we need a systematic account how these spread out clouds or spread out fields or something can only act in a single unified way to give one outcome. So this is the problem that quantum physics has tried to solve over the years, is to understand how things which are spread out and behave like waves while they're spread out can then act only in a single manner with a single response. And the way I want to suggest we can answer this question is to use some ideas from Swedenborg. Now, this is not the way I normally introduce quantum physics, but I'm relying on the fact that you people have some ideas from Swedenborg. So when the basic content of this talk is I want to draw some correspondences between spirituality and quantum physics. Not identity, but correspondences. So that those of you that know Swedenborg will use these correspondences to understand quantum physics. And those that know quantum physics will then can see the reverse process as well. So that we can want to see both sides of the fence, both sides of the line. And so these spread out waves, I say, correspond to us before we decide what to do. Imagine in our mind we're thinking of doing different things. In our mind we entertain possibilities. That's what the function of our understanding is. Okay, our understanding is to think about things before we do them. That's what someone who has a good understanding does. They think about things before acting. They entertain the possibilities, they consider the possibilities, and so the wave pattern that we have is like us entertaining all our probabilities. So there's something that corresponds between wave and understanding. And furthermore, it's more like us thinking rather than an already completed result, okay? I mean, physicists thought that all the electrons and protons and atoms were in a very precise position. That's as if we'd already made up our minds what to do, you see? So, but we know from Swedenborg that you only get a precise outcome at the end of a process that involves intention and understanding and then deciding to act in some way. So I'll expand in more detail as we go along, but what I want to show is that these problems of quantum physics correspond to processes in our minds. This is the thing. There's a connection that I want to say. There's a connection of correspondence, as we would naturally expect, and so we will come up with many more idea. So this is just these things. This last little section is like a preview of the remaining part of the talk. Don't worry if you don't understand it now, but we want to give you a few ideas to help you think of that. But the problem is that in physics, these wave functions which are spread out, they satisfy the shape of these wave functions satisfies well-known equations, but it's still not clear in physics when or exactly how you get one actual outcome. We've got a whole wave, the electron might have a wave function spread out all over this room, but if you had detectors everywhere in the room, only one of the detectors would detect the electron. So in quantum physics, it's still not quite, they just say that it's random, but it's not. They don't have a good reason why an electron can only be found in one detector and not somehow in all of them. And so there's been a lot of discussion over the last 70 years about how in physics, from the theory that I've just described with waves, how you just get one outcome. And this has given rise to an enormous number of alternative ideas. And I've listed these ideas in a sort of order. And those of you that have read anything about popular physics, I believe, will recognize some of these alternatives, but they're all trying to answer the same problem. The first one here is that it's called the many-world interpretation, in which there isn't really a selection, but all alternatives occur at the same time, sort of in some parallel set of parallel universes. And then other theory says that it's really like that, but it appears to a good approximation as if one particular outcome is concerned. One particular outcome is produced. And then these people have introduced the idea of something to do with consciousness or mind. Bohr thought that it was the fact that experimental apparatus was what's called classical and didn't have this wave behavior. That would give rise to a particular outcome. But the point is that we now know that quantum physics applies to the experimental apparatus as well, so that doesn't really solve the problem. Heisenberg suggested that it was when the experimenter looks, and then this has given rise to a whole stream of ideas in which consciousness or other things have become more and more involved in trying to solve the problem of quantum physics. Eugene Wigner, in a paper about 40 years ago, suggested that it was actually the consciousness of the observer. And then this has been carried on by Henry Stapp, in which he says that consciousness is actually involved in the brain, and that the brain has many things that can happen, and our consciousness selects one of these outcomes, or it produces a result. And others have carried this on. Now, I've listed other alternatives here, which get progressively, as we say, more way out, okay? And we know some of them we can imagine being true, okay? We can say that the spirit produces nature, but some people have gone even further than that and have said that the nature is somehow essentially spiritual, it's connected or equal to the spiritual, and I classify that, and others have said that nature and spirit are identical. And others have gone even further by saying that quantum physics really is a way of learning about spirituality, and it helps us retain or regain our spirituality. So there's an enormous range of problems here which all in some way are trying to solve the same problem, is about how something which describes a wave can produce a definite outcome. And the trouble is that when physicists think about nature, they only have two ideas in mind. They can think of a wave or a particle, but the trouble is the objects that quantum physics tells us in nature, that are in nature, are not just waves and they're not just particles. And so the challenge is to get a new understanding, a new picture. Now, as well as those so-called far-out ideas on the previous slide, there's more ideas that have been proposed, and which, if you read in the literature, in the books about quantum physics, James Jeans, a physicist mathematician writing about 60 years ago, and said that the wave function looks like not something solid and substantial, but it looks more like an idea, and people have taken that to mean that the quantum physics tells us about ideas. But of course, and other people have tried in discussing the identity of spirit and nature, have tried to go through various ways of working out why they at least appear to be different. They've said that perhaps they're different grades of energies, different frequencies, different dimensions. Those of us from Swedenborg backgrounds will recognize that these are sort of different dimensions, is trying to use spatial analogies, thinking from space, to distinguish mind from nature. When people try and talk about different frequencies, they're using different times, they're using temporal analogies to think about the difference between spirit and nature. But we know from Swedenborg that you can't really use either of those. So that whenever anyone says spirit and nature are different dimensions, then we know that they're just using ideas from spatial thinking and different frequencies, using ideas from different time thinkings, and then different fineness. There's various ideas that people have suggested. But from Swedenborg, we know, well, we think we know, which of these ideas, all those ideas in the last two transparencies, from the simple to the way out, we know which of them could make sense, which of them could possibly be true. Now, if we go back, so before discussing which of them are true, let's point out which ones could possibly be true. We know that choosing to do one particular thing can't just be an illusion, because otherwise it makes a mockery of trying to order one's life. We know that really particular outcomes are chosen, so it can't just be a good approximation. We know that consciousness is perhaps involved. It's not ruled out, because we know from Swedenborg that spirit produces nature, and it may be that consciousness as part of spirit is involved. And so, but we know that these last three things cannot be true, because we know that there's an essential difference between nature and spirit, and what is and the spirit, which means that we have to find a different kind of connection between quantum physics and spirituality. It's not just identity. There must be another kind of connection between nature and spirit that's not identity. And if we look at these other ideas that people have suggested and work out which of them could possibly be true, we know that, as I've already mentioned, that this discussion of time or dimensions, they can't be true. We know it's not just about fineness or subtlety. Swedenborg has comments to make about that. Actually, it may be true that wave function looks like an idea, but that we'll see that that's only true if we take the word like here to refer to correspondence, okay, and rather than just to be equal. So we can take this claim at the beginning here, and we might a very brief and necessarily cursive introduction to how we can use Swedenborg to understand quantum physics, and how this understanding, well, first of all, I'm going to show that there are multiple levels. I call them multiple generative levels. You probably know them as discrete levels, okay? Swedenborg makes a great effort of distinguishing continuous from discrete levels. And what I'm going to show is that there are discrete levels within the natural, within quantum physics, okay? And this will help us to understand what's going on, as I claim here. And that furthermore, the discrete levels within the natural, we have some discrete levels here within the natural, and these correspond to other discrete levels that we know about in spiritual processes. And then we have this triadic structure within the natural and within the spiritual, and these are linked together by correspondences. So this is a sort of an overall scheme for the rest of the talk. Now, if we recapitulate what Swedenborg tells us about how spirit and nature are combined, if we look at what Swedenborg says after he was told what was actually happening, rather than what he tried to guess at in his earlier years, which is quite different, then we see that he later in life learned that the spirit is an essential means in the creation of nature, that nature is not created immediately from the infinite, but it's created by means of the spirit. So we say that the natural world is a final effect of causes working in the spiritual world, which manifest loves of certain forms, ends of love. And so I don't have to say it in great deal to you, but this pattern of, if you can go from the bottom here, love to wisdom to effect, is the pattern that we'll try and use to understand what's happening in quantum physics and see whether it helps us whether it makes any sense there. And indeed, if we take this pattern, which is, I can summarize in lots of ways, of love to wisdom to effect, or the soul acts by mind in the body. This is the same triadic pattern. And Swedenborg gives us ample reason to show that this is repeated in the soul. We have celestial and spiritual, and the spiritual natural. It's repeated in the mind. We have an interior rational, we have an exterior rational, and a sensory mind. And so the question is it also repeated in the natural world? Now, Swedenborg has a variety of things to say about degrees in the natural world. When he started, he had quite a few different ideas that varied from book to book. And in fact, I'm going to talk about these ethers, which is something that he changed his mind a number of times on, and then in connection how exactly they're related to the spiritual world. But if we take something from Last Judgment, from actually a posthumous one, he says that the three natural atmospheres arising from the sun, a pure ether, which is universal with gravity, a middle ether, which forms a vortex around the planets, in which there are moons and satellites in magnetism, and an ultimate ether, which is air. So this is something that 3 degrees in nature that he did talk about. And these days we don't believe in ether, but the question is, can we interpret what he talks about, middle ether and pure ether, can we interpret them in such a way that makes sense, and ultimate ether? So I'm going to use, when he talks about ether, he uses 3 different adjectives on it. And so I'm going to assume that these refer to different things. He might not have known from a scientific point of view what they were, but they're certainly 3 different things, and they're certainly not just 3 different vacuums. I've heard to some distress that there's replacement of the word ether by vacuum, but this would make a nonsense of this paragraph. Replaced ether everywhere in this paragraph by vacuum, you get something very strange. So the question is, do we recognize this pattern? Does it make sense? We have to allow some flexibility in interpretation of what he meant by ether, but he does tell us what the function of these ethers are. He tells us the first one is to do with gravity, the middle one is to do with magnetism, and the final one is to do with material things. And so does that make sense or not? If we try and work out what these 3 degrees in the natural might be, then now this is still not going to physics, but if we work out from first, New Church principles, what the natural a priori would be expected to consist of, we know that from the correspondences of the natural with the three degrees in the spiritual, we know that in the natural there must be, this is sort of working from the production, the overall point of view, there must be a way of receiving in the body the intentions of the spirit. And furthermore, there must be a propagation of causes within the natural, and there must be a way of producing effects in the natural. So these, we can think of these as ends, cause, and effects in the natural. So this is what we would expect to see from the Swedenborg's point of view in the natural. So the question is, can we see this? Is there a way of looking at what we know about the natural from science in which we see these 3 degrees? Now this is, so I say, in physics we don't know anything about ends. In fact, we deliberately refuse to consider ends in physics as a rule. But we know a great deal about propagation of causes in physics. That's what physics does extremely well. It tells us how causes propagate through sequences and do various things. And in physics, we know a little about effects. The irony is that this whole business that I talked about earlier about getting an actual outcome in quantum physics was precisely because physics doesn't know enough about the actual effects. So that it's clear that contemporary physics knows a lot about propagation of causes, and it knows almost everything about production of effects, but there's still something missing in what quantum physics tells us about the final effects. So that if Swedenborg has any light to cast on what these 3 degrees are, it could help fill in an important loophole, an important gap in quantum physics, which is the production of effects. And that's the thing which led to all that enormous range of beliefs which I talked about earlier. And so if we look at physics and try and first of all look at what physics regards as part of its central understanding, the important idea in physics is energy. Okay, energy is the theme which goes through contemporary physics, and we know about potential energy, we know about kinetic energy. Kinetic energy is energy to do with motion, and potential energy is to do with what would happen if the circumstances were right. Okay, so, and furthermore, energy in quantum physics, you'd add these two together, and in quantum physics you can convert this total of energy into what's called the Hamiltonian operator. And this is an operator which I'll just tell you, it enters into a Schrodinger equation, and it And it tells us all about all these waveforms, these fields of probabilities. It generates all of time evolution. So all the dynamics in quantum physics is specified by knowing what the initial state is and what this Hamiltonian operator is. So energy of some form is very important. So I summarize it at the bottom here by saying in classical physics, we can go a long way by knowing about conservation of energy, and not to mention conservation of momentum and angular momentum as well. But these conservation laws are pretty basic. And in quantum physics, this Hamiltonian operator, which is normally abbreviated H, is the most important thing which governs the dynamics. So whenever I do quantum physics as part of my career, what I do is, okay, quantum physics in practice, what I do is that if I try and solve a problem in atomic physics or nuclear physics, is that I try and find the Hamiltonian, which consists of these kinetic and potential energy. So this is just, this is the only transparency on which there is an equation, you'll be pleased to know. Really to demonstrate that the equation exists, okay? We take the Hamiltonian, which has the kinetic and potential energies, we write down Schrodinger's equation, and basically this H acts on, as an operator which acts on the wave function, and it tells us how the wave function changes. It tells us the derivative with respect to time. That's what I mean by saying that it tells us all the dynamics, because we can solve this equation to find the wave function at all spaces and time into the future. So this is the central equation of quantum physics, is an equation of this form. It might be slightly different. There are other Dirac equations, lots of other related equations, but they're all of the same form. They have the time derivative, how the wave function changes with time. And furthermore, once you've got this wave function, it tells us probabilities. It finds probabilities by taking the square modulus of this. Oh, I seem to have got my E. So these little E acutes should be taken as arrows. Okay. Unfortunately, the font didn't come out right. So the question is, do we see a triad of end going to cause, going to effects in this structure? I mean, I've just described the structure of quantum physics as every quantum physicist, every atomic physics, every nuclear physicist will tell you that this is what the structure is. Do we see the triad there? And the way, and what I claim is that we do, if we look at it properly. I claim that there's a sequence of three things. Now, if you're not sure what they are, I've, at the bottom here, drawn the correspondences to what they are in the mind, okay? So those of you that know quantum physics can look up here, and those of you who know the Swedenborg or psychology can look here, and want to draw the connection between them, okay? So if you know one, these connections will help you understand the other. So I'm saying that if we look at what quantum physics is, we have this Hamiltonian, which is to do with total energy. I haven't really explained the difference between potential and kinetic energy, but there's the total energy there. It's somehow active because it produces a Hamiltonian operator. An operator operates on a wave function and changes it. It tells us how wave function changes. So the Schrodinger equation is how the Hamiltonian produces this, what I call a tendency wave, or this wave function, which is a wave of propensities or tendencies for action, probability waves. And then this wave function, you take its square modulus, and then you get a probability for different actual outcomes. So this is the structure of quantum physics. And in this structure, we see this, the same kind of triad of degrees as we have in our minds. And this is a very simple triad from psychology, which if we can imagine just in the external mind, we can think of attention, thinking about plans leading to action. But it's the same, it's the corresponding triad. It's not the same triad, but it's the corresponding triad, okay? So if you, from Swedenborg, we know all about love and wisdom and use, or affection and understanding and decision, etc. Or celestial and spiritual and natural. It's the same triad again, see. So as we know from Swedenborg, the same pattern repeats itself in the whole and in each part. So I'm just talking about what happens in the very, in every single process which happens to do, and for every single particle of quantum physics, every time it does, every time it evolves slightly in time, we have the same pattern. Even in the most microscopic individual electron evolution of time, we see the same triadic pattern of something leading to some distribution leading to a result. Okay? And so there's a correspondence there. And I'll come back to this correspondence. But I'll just mention in passing that the we see there's a correspondence between energy and intention. Now, it's very popular these days to see, to use energy in a very general way to refer to all of intentions in our mind and in our spirit. We talk about mental energy, we talk about spiritual energy. But and many people confuse these or conflate spiritual energy with physical energy and saying they're just different kinds of energies. But here we can see, well, and we'll see in more detail later, that they correspond to each other. And Swedenborg would use, am I going to talk about it? I think I mentioned it now. He would use heat and light, okay? And I think the word energy is a good translation for heat, calor, or whatever, in Swedenborg. And then here in the middle we have waves or fields, because these are waves or field structures. And so Swedenborg refers to light. But these waves are waves of energy, okay? The waves of energy spreading out and trying to do something. So Swedenborg refers to light as a form of, well, light is a form of energy, we know. He says, wisdom is the form of love. He says, and intentions take form in the understanding. So there's a lot of similarities in the logical structure of the sentences which connect these first 2 degrees. Okay, so this is just a little bit of... Now, those of you that wonder how quantum physics differs from the physics we know, I'll just give a brief demonstration here of how this makes a difference. Okay, imagine someone roller skating in a hollow, which I'm sure you've seen. Perhaps not here, but at least elsewhere. Do you have a hollow here? In classical physics, there's a limit, okay? There's a limit here of what's called the classically forbidden limit. It's the limit in which the kinetic energy runs out and everything turns into potential energy. But in quantum theory, there's no sharp limit, because there are tendencies, not just everything is predetermined and rigid. In quantum physics, if this were a particle, like an electron in an atom, it appears with a small probability, even in what's called the classically forbidden region, okay? And with some small probability. And this is extremely important in quantum physics. And this gives rise to what, in my opinion, is interesting about quantum physics, because I say it's essential to understanding transistors. They tunnel, electrons tunnel through very thin layers. Because if you have another dip on the right-hand side, they can get through. The same thing appears with radioactive decay, because a radioactive decay, a proton or an alpha particle inside a big nucleus has a big barrier which stops getting out, but it can still tunnel out with a very small probability, and therefore you get a very long lifetime, like thousands of millions of years, but it still gets out eventually, Okay, so that's one of the differences between classical and quantum physics, which comes about because there are these tendencies and not just hard and fast limits. And the fact of having tendencies is related to what Swedenborg tells us, that there are intentions or what... kinetics or various things that go on that produce the results, and that it's not just a fixed connection between them. Okay, so what I've given is a brief summary of the correspondences between energy and waves and events in quantum physics, and intention and understanding of thoughts and effects in the mind. So perhaps we should do it the other way around. We normally draw the mind above the physics, okay? Intention, understanding effects corresponds to energy and form and waves. Now, I said that in quantum physics, the Hamiltonian, which is where we started in this picture, is comprised of potential and kinetic energy. So the question is, where does the Hamiltonian come from? Okay? And now I'm going to try and describe what's called quantum field theory. Now, you might not follow me, but at least I'll have a go, because it's important to the argument that physics has discovered more about what's, so to speak, behind the Hamiltonian. Where does the Hamiltonian come from? We don't just invent it. I mean, when quantum physics started 70 years ago, you had to invent the Hamiltonian, okay? You tried various clues and tricks, and if the results came out right, you know you're successful. But really, there's some physics behind that. We know the potential energy part of the Hamiltonian, so electric potential energy, is not just arbitrary, but it comes about from what's called virtual processes. We know that electromagnetic forces between two charged particles is not just something given by Maxwell's equations, but it's given by virtual photons. There are photons that exchange themselves. The attraction between two protons or two proton and neutron is not just arbitrary, but it's given by exchange of quarks and gluons, and quarks attract to each other by exchanging gluons. So there's something going on behind the scenes of what I've described so far, which produces the Hamiltonian. Okay, so what's that? What are these events? And so that's just what the potential energy comes from. And I'll just mention that the kinetic energy is to do with mass, and furthermore, that if these other, this mass is what the physicists say is dressed by virtual processes. By that I mean that a bare electron has a cloud of photons going along with it, because it continually emitting and receiving photons, and these photons have mass of their own. So even the kinetic energy is not something, and the mass is not something which is given immediately, but it's also produced from behind the scenes and in the Hamiltonian, which contains the kinetic and potential energies together. So I've just mentioned what some of these virtual processes are. This is physics that's been discovered in the last 50 years, that protons, electromagnetic interaction, for instance, between the oppositely charged particles is by exchange of a photon, between two protons, exchange of a gluon. And people ask me about weak interaction. There's what's called heavy vector mesons, Z and W particles, which the exchange of these Zs and Ws is responsible for what's called the weak decay, which is a third kind of interaction. So in physics, we say that there are four kinds of interactions altogether. There's these three here: electromagnetism, the strong interaction, and the weak interaction. And the fourth one is gravity. So far, I haven't talked about gravity. Okay, so we'll come back to gravity later. But the point I want to make is that all of these things are going on behind the scenes, and physicists say these are virtual particles. They don't say they're actually happening, but they're sort of virtually happening. And then there's a challenge for us people who want to understand physics: what on earth is going on? And I say it over here, not actually happening, but virtually. And the way I want you to think about it is that these virtual processes are the means by which plans are produced, okay? You remember I said we have love and intention and effects. But intention, understanding, and effects. But the understanding has all these plans, but the question is how the plans worked out. There must be something to help these work out. And from Swedenborg we know that all the thoughts to do with this working out comes from prior levels, okay? We know that the influx from the heaven is essential for us to even think, to even get our understanding working, to operate our plans. And so what I propose to help us understand it is that there's another layer of three triadic effects like this. And not all of you will have understood exactly what I meant by field theory, but the point is, what I want to demonstrate is that by looking at these triadic groups and postulating another one, we get some understanding which helps us to understand quantum physics, because we have this middle layer is to do with virtual processes or potential energies, okay? And then this bottom layer is what I had to start with. This deals with the energy and the tendency and the actual events. But the point is that this middle layer comes about by its own autonomous degree of processes in which virtual events are produced by virtual quantum fields, and starting off with what in physics is called a field Lagrangian. Now, we don't really know where the Lagrangian comes from. Again, we've got the same problem, but at least we can see that that virtual processes help prepare the potential energy and the kinetic energy. They help prepare these tendencies. So there are virtual events appearing even if nothing actually happens, okay? So these virtual processes are there even if there's nothing of this final approach. I mean, even if you take the space in this room between atoms, there are still virtual processes going on. And the physicists say that there's what's called zero-point energy. They say there's a vacuum. They say the physical vacuum consists of fluctuations of zero-point energy. And what they're talking about is virtual fields, even when there's no main particle fields, they say that there are these virtual fields which produce measurable effects. So what I want to do now is to identify these two layers with the air layer and the middle ether layer, okay? Because Swedenborg's middle ether was the one he said associated with the planets and the bearer of magnetism. He knew about magnetism, he knew about planets. So, but that's exactly the main... And now, in this room, the main function of these virtual events is the production of electrostatic attraction and magnetic attraction and repulsion, etc., between oppositely charged particles. For us, that's the main purpose of these virtual events, is to have opposite charges repelling and like charges attracting. And now we know that magnetism doesn't exist by itself. It's always combined with electrostatics. So we say we have electromagnetism. So I then interpret Swedenborg's magnetism to refer to what we know is unified with that, which is electromagnetism. So this looks like the middle ether. It has the same, it has the correct order. It has the correct internal structure from Swedenborg's point of view. Okay? If we have the same thing of principle going to cause. And in fact, we don't know where the principle comes from, but we can see that it is a principle. This is the principle that physicists have used until very recently as the sort of the initial point. When they want to describe the quantum field theory, they start by writing down the Lagrangian. And then they look at all the terms of the Lagrangian, and then they work out all the virtual processes. They do the one-step and the two-step, and they use perturbation theory and big computers, and work out virtual events. Then they work out the potential and kinetic energy, and then they carry on with the process. So this is all just describing in a simple way what happens, what physics is doing these days. And a picture like this, without the words middle ether and air, would be agreeable by my colleagues at work. I've tried it on them, okay? It's sensible from the physics point of view, in which the only thing that they find a little bit odd is that there is this strict order. Okay? Then there's no sort of give and take, reciprocal interaction. So I've always drawn the arrows producing like this, okay? So the whole business of influx and influx and or conditional influx, what you need to get influx is something which I don't think I'll have time to talk about. That's really another talk. But at least from Swedenborg we know that there is this order. Okay, so we have a middle ether and we have an air. So what about gravity? Okay, that's the thing which is missing there. Okay, let's summarize what we know about gravity in one transparency. Okay? according the best theory of gravity is Einstein's general relativity. It doesn't
It's still the best theory. No one has disproved it, okay? Physicists are not happy with it, for reasons which I'll explain, but it's still the best theory. And in this theory, space and time are curved by gravity according to the matter in the distribution of matter, okay? They say, I'm not going to write down Einstein's equation, but basically he says the curvature of space-time is proportional to the mass and energy in space-time. And this means that there's no mention of probabilities or anything. It's purely what physicists call a classical theory. And the result of this is that questions of quantum gravity are hotly discussed. There's been an enormous amount of discussion of how we could possibly have quantum gravity in the last 20 or 30 years of physicists. The amount of theoretical effort for physicists in trying to understand quantum gravity is enormous, and they still don't really know if it's even possible. They don't know, because if space and time are somehow probabilistically generated, then how do you even talk about probabilities? Because we don't have a sort of distribution of space and ought to have probabilities in. And there must be alternatives, etc., in some way. So that there's hope that if we have insight into these problems of quantum gravity from Swedenborg, then we'll be able to cast some light. Now, according to Swedenborg, if we're in a spiritual world, we know that the space and time we see in the spiritual world is very flexible. Let's put it that way. It depends on our mental state, our spiritual state. We know that if two people's loves are similar, then they're close together in the spiritual world. Okay? We know that the sun, the state of the Lord in the heavens, is so different from the state of the angels that this appears as an enormous distance between them. Okay? It appears as a sun, but the sun is the source of life, so the sun is shining on us. And we know that time is also very flexible in the spiritual world. It seems to be a rule that if someone asks you to do something and you say you're going to do it immediately, but you want to do lots of other things before you do it, you've always got time to have a digression and do whatever else you wanted to do and then come back in the time that the person asked you to do, because there's no clock time in the spiritual world. There's only a succession of states, and you could always have many successions of states of one thing between any transition of states for something else. So there is a kind of time in the spiritual world, but it's only a succession of states, and it's not the same order or the same rate of succession by any means in different parts. So again, we see that space and time vary according to loves. And I want to draw a correspondence here. This is not really a theory, but it's just I'm trying to get a unified view of what's going on so we can begin to see correspondences. According to Swedenborg, loves dynamically generate the geometry of space and time that you see, okay? But we know that loves correspond to energy, so let's take this sentence and translate it by correspondence into physics. And we end up with a statement that energies dynamically generate the geometry of physical space and time, which is what we know, which is what general relativity says. That makes sense, okay? We don't really understand the connections between love and energies or why or how this works, but we can see the beginning of some ideas there which may, in the future, generate interesting insights. And this suggests that our layers of air and middle ether need to be extended to what I call a prior formative degree. Now, this is really speculative, okay? I'm just using ideas of correspondences from Swedenborg to fill in the gaps. Okay, so these nine layers, which I've shaded in pink, are the bottom six of the six that I've talked about before. We have actual selections, propensity fields, and energy, and then we have virtual events, virtual fields, and the Lagrange, and whatever that is. But then I'm saying that we would expect some layer up here, some prior layer, which acts as the the principle and the cause and effect in that direction, okay? Everything comes in triads, so to speak, so we can't just have six, you've got to have nine, you've got to have a multiple, a power of three. And so it seems that there must be some general principle here, then there must be some formative fields here, and then the effect of these formative fields must be to generate space-time. So there must be an even prior layer, which is to do with gravity. Now, we don't really know anything about this, and in fact, if all the physicists that I know were thinking about quantum gravity could actually think of something useful, then we might have something to say. But conversely, if from Swedenborg we understood our correspondences perfectly well, we might also have something to say, okay? So it's the challenge is to get everything meeting in the middle, okay? We're trying to connect heaven and earth here, trying to see how they join up. But the point is, this first layer is what Swedenborg says in his later ideas of the natural was the first ether. He said this was the first ether associated with gravity. So it looks like here we have a first ether, a middle ether, and then air. That seems to make sense. As long as we interpret Swedenborg's, the way you interpret Swedenborg was, Swedenborg was trying to tell what he knew to be true in the words which he had available to him. I mean, isn't that what revelation is? We had to use the words that were there. He could suggest things. There are many things he didn't know. I could talk endlessly about things he didn't know, but which we now know to be important, and we have to work out what these things that he didn't tell us are. But this is an example of, we see the same pattern like this. We see, in this direction, we see principle, cause and effect, or love, wisdom, use, or intention, understanding, effect, whatever you like, and then the same principle like this, and so that the influx must come in the sequence, 1 to 9, like this. It must be the way the world is produced. And these are all in the natural, okay? This is not anything to do with mental, not anything to do with spiritual, but it's all in the natural. These are discrete degrees, I say at the bottom, all in the natural. And so, I think I don't need to say a lot about how there can be partial views, because I think I've made this point already, that the lowest triad is energy to wave to event, corresponds to will, thought and choice, but it's not identical. But people who see these correspondences, who feel these correspondences, a lot of correspondences have built themselves into the language of today, insight and warmth and etc. etc. are words which you use so often. But what we can see, there are correspondences. The role of energy in the body corresponds to the role of love in the spirit. And Swedenborg calls it heat. Okay, I call it energy, but it's whatever it is. It's something at the beginning that corresponds to the love side. The role of waves in the world corresponds to wisdom. Now, waves in the world, light waves. We say that we know that wisdom corresponds to light. Okay, so I say light here, and then the role of actual events corresponds to decisions in the spirit, which are the effects, the end of the physical. Now, quantum physics is still not quite sure about the effects. As I said at the beginning, there's still some unfinished business in physics to do with what the effects are, or what actually produces the effects. But, okay, let me say that on this business of partial views, people often conflate the energy in the body with love in the spirit by saying that there are spiritual energies in us, okay? They talk about spiritual energy. They talk about waves, auras as waves. They can see waves around people. Maybe they can, but it's not waves in the normal sense. And furthermore, all those people at the beginning who are trying to understand quantum physics saw that there was a correspondence, or they were built on the fact that the correspondence between physical events and spiritual decisions, by saying that spiritual events were actual decisions, okay? But some of that's true because they seem to correspond, and so therefore we'd expect a causal relation, because the correspondence has come about from causal influx, which are the causes that we're talking about. Now, I said that physics consists of effects, and then forces or fields, and then energy. and people have thought that this energy was so different from the physical world that it must be tell us already about spirit, but it tells us only something that corresponds to spirit. Other people have seen this lower, my bottom layer of energy propensities and events, and they've looked back up to this, the virtual processes, and they've seen these virtual processes are here even if there's nothing actually happening. Maybe it's these virtual processes which correspond to spirit, or are spirit. And so we even get papers, I just saw one recently, so I had to print out the abstract. Are virtual photons the elementary carriers of consciousness? This is from a journal which appeared just recently, and I just do it to show the kind of partial views or the conflation of correspondences. You don't have to read it all, but I have to read to you the second to last sentence. Due to the omnipresence of virtual photons, it follows finally that the whole universe must be imbued with subjectivity. Okay, this is what happens if you don't distinguish one prior degree from the real prior degrees, which are in the spiritual. They correspond to each other, but they're not equal. Okay, this is the challenge. So this whole talk was about quantum physics and spirituality. There's a correspondence between them, but they're not equal. How are we going for time? Is there a chairman? Are you the chairman?
What's
are you the chairman?
Yes.
How am I going for time? When did I start?
There's no...
Okay. I'll just mention a few other things which come about to do with these events, okay? This idea of physical actual selections being important, also being the final result, the bottom line, the whole spiritual world produces the external spirit world and then produces all these degrees in the natural, and the last thing it produces, these actual selections of one particular outcome against another. I mean, that's what quantum physics doesn't understand, but we know that it must be there. And so I say that the final acts of the spirit are in the sense, we know the final acts of the spirit are in the sensory mind, okay? That's what Swedenborg tells us. Psychologists would say it's the sensory motor mind, which is actually slightly more accurate because it's the actions. It's not just the sensations, but it's the actions. And we know from what I've just described that the final acts in the world are these actual events, the selections of one particular outcome that's distinct from another. And there's still some discussion about what they actually are, but that's what has to be there. But these two things appear to correspond to each other. So Heisenberg, Wigner and Stapp and others have, even Paul Davies, thinks that there's some connection between observers and the selection of actual events. But we now see that they correspond to each other. So one of them must cause, there's something about the sensory motor mind, the outermost layer of the external mind, the operation of action there must in some way be connected to selecting a particular outcome. Okay? And this explains, I say, in part, how the natural world terminates. It terminates in the selection of a particular outcome. It's in the world, the natural world, that we really build up a fixed foundation, because these actual events, which are the bottom line, are the definite choices of one way or the other. And so Swedenborg says that the natural world thereby terminates and contains as a containment for spiritual life and action. So it must be that the loves which remain with us are the loves which produce the actual events in our lives. Okay, I mean, this is what really essentially Swedenborg is telling us. Now, this is all part of a big story, of course, which I'm sure many of you know more about than I, but basically we know that there's an interior mind, an exterior mind in the natural world. And so what I've been talking about are the 9 degrees in this natural world, which are what I call the formative level, virtual process and actual effects. And so that on the right, do you want to put another tape in?
In a minute.
Okay. The on the right here, this vertical column, we have nature. In the middle, we have mind, which has the central or the sensory motor mind. We have an external rational or scientific, and we have an internal rational, which is produced after Reformation. And then on the left we have the same pattern again in the heavens. So these are the spiritual heavens. So all this talk so far has just been describing the 9 degrees and ennead within the natural world. And of course the whole thing is an ennead, a ninefold set, in which we can see that there's Swedenborg and others go into great detail about the division, the internal degrees within the internal rational. The whole process of Genesis is the progression from Abraham to Jacob and up to Joseph and then beyond, which are all processes of regenerating the internal rational. The structure of these degrees it allows us to make sense of the idea that quantum physics tells us that the things in the world are spread out fields which act in a unified way to give one actual outcome, because that's the way we are. When we think, we have an intention which thinks about many different possibilities and then acts on one of them. That's what life is, okay? And what we're seeing is that physical nature is no different. It's not conscious of itself in the same way, but it's the same kinds of processes, the same function, this similarity of functions. And so this helps us to understand quantum physics. And the natural ways correspond to the natural correspond to the spiritual, and we see how these old degrees are joined together. And so, in conclusion, we see that there is what I call a thorough correspondence, a correspondence in detail as well as in the overall structure, although necessarily we only have the overall structure yet, but there, as far as we can tell, there are details and correspondences in each detail between the functions in quantum nature and the functions in the internal and external mind. So they're not equality of substance, okay, but it's the functional patterns in nature are the same as the functional patterns in the internal mind, and the same as the same as the functional patterns in the external mind. And therefore, when we put all these pictures together, we learn more about nature as well as learning more about spirit, and therefore we get, I hope, a better picture of each, and in particular the relation between them, because that's the challenge, is to understand, as I said before, the connection between heaven and earth. And so I'll just leave up some references to further details for anyone's interested. Thank you.
Thank you.